Wow.
What's up?
I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Hi, I'm Kelly Corrigan. You've probably never heard of me. Maybe you did. I wrote some New York Times bestsellers. I gave a TED Talk. But the reason I'm in your ear now is to invite you to listen to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. We talk to everyone from Bono to Amy Schumer, Spike Lee to Rainn Wilson, Krista Tippett and Bryan Stevenson about purpose, creativity, well-being, and what makes life worth living. Follow and listen to Kelly Corrigan Wonders on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03 on Wednesday afternoon, January 22nd. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hart. The catastrophic wildfires in California having an effect on the entire insurance industry. We'll cover that in our next segment. But right now, young people are increasingly eager to learn about investing and finance. College students across the U.S. flocking to courses on the subject, and many are eager to get started with managing their money. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Ed Jurtzen, certified financial planner and founder of the Engage Wealth Group in Chicago. Find him online, theengagewealthgroup.com. Ed, thank you for joining us today. And there's a side of me that just wonders if the kids today put down their phones and managed to deal with the momentary TikTok ban by turning on the noon business hour. But sadly, that does not seem to be the reason why Gen Z is flocking to learn more about financial education, but we will reap the benefits of it.
Yeah, Rob, you know, it's exciting and encouraging to see young people, right, especially taking an interest in personal finance and investing, because that bodes well for the future. Really understanding the foundational premises of what and how to, you know, gain wealth over time. But it does give me pause that all of a sudden there's a heightened interest in investing, and it harkens back to the bubbles that we've had in the past, the dot-com bubble and the real estate bubble. The fact that some people may think that this is actually easy and making money is easy, when those of us who've had this long experience in the markets know otherwise.
Now, as a result of my job on the Noon Business Hour, the algorithm, at least on Instagram, keeps sending in my direction financial services videos geared toward the younger investor. And maybe I'm like in the responsible lane, because all of the financial social media product that I see and consume all talks about the principles that we discuss in the Noon Business Hour every day, the power of compounding and things like that. And it doesn't really encourage risky behavior. However, there is a lot of risky behavior out there that you might say could be potentially lucrative.
You know, again, what all investors need to be aware of is the risky behavior is not necessarily the high flying stock and or cryptocurrency or name whatever people are flocking to today. It's equities in general, Rob. I mean, equities in general are risky. They can go up 50%, they can go down 50%. And so fundamentally, starting with a basic knowledge of just economics 101 and basic investing is a great way to start. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of different kind of investment disciplines, ideas, and strategies, but ultimately you want to find one that fits for you in good times and in bad. What you don't want to do, and what your listeners need to remind themselves of, is you don't want to make a reactionary change in your portfolio, for instance, selling out of all stocks because you feel the losses are too big. So that's kind of the key element, is really understanding risk and knowing quite well that equities, stocks are risk.
And then also, very quickly, Ed, the whole idea of learning about personal finance, we discuss the stock market a great deal on this show, and I think a lot of people think about equities when they talk about an education in personal finance, but that's only a small component of it. I mean, I would imagine some of these classes would involve examining your own spending and your debt and how much interest you're paying on that debt.
It's an excellent point, Robin. For us as comprehensive financial planners, typically people come to us and they only want to talk portfolios, but then we start expanding that out. It's, are you saving well? What kind of saving vehicles? 401k, 403bs, Roths. And to your point, there's much more to personal finance than just investments. Investments are a cornerstone, but be curious and learn other elements about personal finances. And again, it'll go a long, long way in terms of helping you reach that financial independence.
Ed Jurtzen, certified financial planner and founder of the Engage Wealth Group in Chicago. Find him online at theengagewealthgroup.com. Thank you for joining us today.
Compounding your interest with an economy of words. This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
The financial impact of the Los Angeles wildfires is staggering, with losses estimated to exceed $250 billion, making it one of the costliest disasters in U.S. history. Joining us to discuss the fallout is Kathy Seifert, Senior VP, CFRA Research in New York. Kathy, thank you for joining us today. And this is such a staggering disaster in terms of the just sheer amount of land burned by these wildfires. It's almost so large, it's very difficult to come up with a reliable estimate of the damage just in terms of insured losses and then the wider economic impact.
Yes, and it's great to be with you. And this is, you know, this is really becoming more of an economic event rather than just an insurance event. But I will say this, we are starting to get a little more clarity. As a matter of fact, just this morning, a catastrophe risk modeling firm came out with an updated estimate for insured losses, meaning the amount of money that the insurance companies will pay out. And that number was between $28 and $35 billion. That $250 billion, which is a massive number, is considered the total economic impact. Not all of that is going to be borne either by consumers or by insurers. It's a measure of the loss of economic activity, healthcare issues. So it's truly a macro number. Either way, we're talking about, this is a significant event with a lot of far-reaching implications for a lot of different entities.
Chubb, Cincinnati Financial, Travelers, and Northbrook-based Allstate all have exposure to this particular wildfire. Now, even though the $20 to $30 billion in insured losses will be spread out amongst a number of companies that do business in Southern California, what is that going to do to the insurance industry as a whole, and what is that going to do to premiums, perhaps, of people who aren't affected by the wildfires?
Sure. It's a very good question. And I think it's important for investors in this space to remember that insurers, particularly publicly traded insurers like the companies you just mentioned, have significantly limited their exposure to California because of the way California forced companies to set rates. They had a retrospective process. And what I mean by that is most other states allow insurance companies to use forward-looking models and forward-looking projections to set rates. California had, pardon my use of the word, stubbornly, the regulators stubbornly held on to what had become somewhat of an antiquated rate setting model, making it very difficult for insurers to earn a profit, in particularly in the homeowners market. So many pulled back. So I think the implications of this fire are that there is really going to become a crisis of availability for homeowners insurance in the state of California. It had been building for some time, honestly, almost a decade since we started to see wildfires really kind of rear their ugly heads 8-9 years ago. One important change, though, is January of this year, the regulators have finally relented and are now going to permit insurance companies to look ahead in setting rates. So what this means for California homeowners, if you can get insurance, it's going to be a lot more expensive. How that broadens out across the broader market is that climate change is increasing the severity and the frequency of weather-related losses. Those costs are being borne by insurance companies, particularly homeowners insurers, and ultimately the consumer is going to pay for that.
Kathy Seifert, Senior VP, CFRA Research in New York, thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, Netflix users will be paying more for their streaming content.
It's 60 Minutes of Financial Planning. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Netflix raising prices as it enjoys a surge in new subscribers. Joining us with the details is Tim Hanlon, founder and CEO of the Viterra Group in Chicago. Tim, thank you for joining us today. And in the spirit of the beatings will continue until morale improves, it seems like Netflix will continue to hike its monthly fee as long as the subscriber growth is sustainable.
Well, there's no question that they're a juggernaut. They are at 300 million subscribers across the globe. In the United States, they are supreme amongst all the major streamers. And there's no question that Netflix has pricing power and will exert that pricing power because they are the first choice for everybody in streaming. And that's why I think you see, after having spent the last 18 months shifting a lot of people off of ad-free subscription tiers into ad-supported, albeit less expensive, tiers, now are actually now going to now start to raise those lower ad-supported tiers by a couple of bucks or two. So the reality is that they've got pricing power. They are essentially, by all accounts, essentially in the United States in particular, a fully penetrated service. And they're not going to be reporting subscriber numbers really on a regular basis anymore to Wall Street, because really the emphasis is less about sort of winning new consumers. There's pretty much all of them that they've gotten. They might sort of ebb and flow a bit. But really now they want to focus their attention on other metrics, such as building that advertising business, which is still relatively small but hugely profitable if they get it right down the road.
At what point will some of these studios backing rival streaming services when will they decide it may make more financial sense to just merely license their programming to Netflix and collect the fee as opposed to starting that streaming service of their own? When do they fold?
I think that's a very, very good question. I honestly believe there will be a separation, I guess, of some of the major players that can stick with it and pursue the same similar level of scale. And I think there will be others that will just sort of give up that ghost and indeed go back to that model, which ironically is what fueled Netflix in the beginning, which is licensed content to various sources. And I think you're also going to see some consolidation, right? So there are plenty of streaming services out there that have, you know, the Paramount Pluses of the world and the Peacocks of the world. While they are all good and interesting any given day, the reality is that they are not nearly as scaled nor as voluminous in terms of the variety of content and offerings that keep people sticking around. And Netflix certainly has that going for them. So I think you're going to see some of the smaller ones figure out maybe that they cannot compete with Netflix. And by the way, most of them also have big linear television assets saddled amongst their corporate setups. So I think you're going to see a lot more drama when it comes to who's going to keep up with Netflix and who's not.
Tim Hanlon, founder and CEO of the Viterra Group in Chicago, thank you for joining us today. Still ahead in Personal Finance Wednesday, some help in helping in deciding your best side hustle.
This is Chicago's news, traffic, and weather station, News Radio 105.9. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. Planned Parenthood restructuring operations in Illinois as we move away from sub-zero cold. Other parts of the country are grappling with rare winter weather. Personal Finance Wednesday, we discuss ways to narrow your focus when seeking out a side hustle. As Macy's closes stores across the country, questions are being floated about its State Street location in Chicago. WBBM Business, the markets are higher. The Dow is up 152 points. The NASDAQ is up 251. The S&P 500 up 43. AccuWeather says for today, cloudy, breezy, very cold. Little snow and flurries at times. A high today of 23. AccuWeather real field temperatures in the single digits. 18 right now at O'Hare with snow flurries. Feels like three above. It's 12:31, topping our news at the half hour. Planned Parenthood of Illinois says it's making changes to deal with a financial shortfall. It's closing its health center in Chicago's Englewood neighborhood, along with locations in Ottawa, Decatur, and Bloomington. It cites multiple reasons for the action, including a need to create a sustainable future after the overturning of the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court precedent nearly 2 years ago. An historic winter storm has dumped nearly a foot of snow on places in the deep south and southeast. Have never seen that much before. Temperatures are also at record lows. This man struggling to stay warm in Selma, Alabama.
I had to get the long johns on. I had to go back in the house and regroup. The wind chill makes it worse.
It's even snowing in Gulf Shores, Alabama, right on the beach. Communities from Texas to the Carolinas are under the influence of the storm system. It's 12:32 as the noon business hour continues. Markets are higher today. We welcome in J.J. Kinahan, CEO of IG North America, president of Tasty Trade in Chicago. J.J., thank you for joining us today. And it seems like the markets are building on the momentum from yesterday's rally.
They are, and then we had the excitement around the AI infrastructure that was announced last night. You pile on top of that some really good earnings from Netflix, some good earnings from United Airlines, and then a stock that I think gets overlooked by a lot of people but has a big influence, particularly on the Dow, and that's Travelers Insurance, which, you know, is up about 4.5% right now. And I think that's one that maybe took the market by surprise. You know, you've been reporting on your station has all the L.A. obviously issues. So to see a reinsurer come out with positive statements going forward after that, or in the midst of, I should say, because it's not over, that crisis, I think, was something that gave the market a little extra shot in the arm also.
So how much of this is new administration optimism, and how much of this is earnings season coming in above expectation so far?
I think it's a combination thereof, to be honest with you. You know, at the end of the day, earnings drive markets, and so seeing good earnings has furthered the momentum of a new administration. And I think, you know, many people on a new administration say, oh, regulations going away, blah, blah. It's not that regulations necessarily going away as much as perhaps some of the clutter and tape that you had to go through to get things done is going away. So I just think there was this excitement around getting things done more quickly. And now you pile on to that the fact that companies not only have been releasing good earnings, but more importantly, have been releasing positive statements going forward about their ability to continue to build on, let's face it, you know, we're near all-time PE ratios, but companies saying, hey, our earnings will catch the price, and I think that's what really has the market excited.
It also seems like the T word, tariff, which has been thrown about quite a bit this week in discussions of maybe levying 25% tariffs on Mexico and Canada, another announcement on a 10% tariff on China beginning as soon as February 1st, that even though the tariff discussion and the economic uncertainty they could create, it's out there, but it seems like investors are just setting it off to the side.
Yeah, I think some of the boogeyman types, oh my God, it's going to be the worst thing in the world, has certainly been set aside. And so with that, I think what you'll continue to see, the news, like most things in life, right, Rob, the news is actually often not as bad as what you expect it can be. And I think that many thought that President Trump would come in and just do tariffs across the board. And as we all know, a lot of times he makes statements just to as a negotiating point. And so on this one, I think people are like, well, let's wait and see what actual tariffs are, even though, to your point, that word has been thrown around a lot, in a, particularly so far this week.
Yeah, this is a point I made yesterday. It seems like everybody has to maybe get their sea legs back, as it were, in terms of just remembering what the news flow was like between 2017 and 2021. Just remembering what that was like on a day-to-day basis and assessing economic policy from this White House.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is said. It almost seems like any negotiation, even things that don't seem to necessarily be a negotiation, are sometimes presented as a negotiation. And I feel like that's what's kind of done here. So you have to take a step back from every statement that's made and say, okay, what's the real intent?
JJ,
I think the market is learning that.
Well, JJ Kinahan, CEO of IG North America, president of Tasty Trade in Chicago, thank you for joining us once again today. Coming up next in Personal Finance Wednesday, a discussion on side hustles.
Money talks as the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Personal Finance Wednesday, and many people review their income, debt, and expenses at the beginning of the year and realize they could all benefit from a side hustle. With so many options available, how do you choose the right one for you? Let's get some insight from Rick Cobb, founder of the workplace consulting firm To Discern in Chicago. Rick, thank you for joining us today. And the common image I think a lot of people have of a side hustle in this day and age, the first place their head goes is, oh, you're going to drive an Uber. You're going to be an Uber driver, a Lyft driver, DoorDash. That's a way to make some extra money on your own time. But there are so many different side hustles out there, Rick, and they can work inside your time and schedule and make economic sense.
They can. And by the way, yeah, Ben Johnson got hired as the Bears coach, so my side hustle plans are over.
Sorry. They interviewed like, what, 200 people, and you were 201.
Yeah, I didn't get on the list. So one of the things I want to caution people about, depending on the job that you currently have, is to make sure that you understand your legal exposure here. I mean, it's a great thing to do if you can make it work in your life, but I can tell you from personal experience with clients I've worked with, where they've independently had a side hustle, the company finds out about it, and either it is against the rules or they are very uncomfortable about the idea that this person is just basically amping up to leave. So, you know, keep that in the back of your mind. The other thing that's really important for people to go through is a reality check. And one of the best ways to do that is when you start to consider a side hustle, whatever it happens to be, just take the time to write down on one page a description of what it is that you want to do and who's going to be the customer. And then take a day or so to play that out with people in front of them, say, hey, you would be interested, you would be the kind of person I'd want to offer these services to. How do you feel about that? And then lastly, make sure that your family members understand what that would do to your life with them and with them as well before you actually get full tilt into it. Those are critical. And then once you get past that, then start to think about, okay, what's this look like? What am I going to do? You can become, there's a lot of people that do very well with technology skills, whether they have trades experiences. They're good writers, they're good at marketing, they're good at you name it, whatever they're good at. And there's lots of platforms out there for you that you can use to help you. Upwork, Fiverr, TopTal, GitHub, I can go on. And none of those words mean anything unless you're in that industry.
Now, I mean, side hustle, there's obviously freelancing, which I think that was the old word for it.
Sure.
before the youths got involved. But I mean, even just doing something like, for example, there's someone in the office who not too long ago needed some extra income just because kids are expensive, and they became a soccer coach. Several years ago, I guess you could call it a side hustle, and I was very transparent about it with the management at the radio station at the time, was I became a freelance contributor to CBS News Radio. I did a daily entertainment feature. I produced it in the basement after the kids went to bed, but I did that for a couple of months, and that was some extra, you know, spending money and necessary, and did a couple of documentaries for the network, and that was freelance work, but also everybody here knew about it, and so I was very open and honest about it, and it worked out fairly well.
Yeah, there are people that happen to naturally be very organized, which seems like that maybe that's what you should have. But there are people that have a side hustle where they actually will come into your home and help you organize your personal life, whether it's actually helping you work on your paperwork, your tax situation, how your office is laid out, or even helping you figure out how to coordinate your closet and your clothing and your drawers and just get all that stuff out of the way and help you give you the willpower to get rid of some things that you never use that you've been hoarding. Organizational structure like that. There are people that certainly can coach you in languages, in music, in writing, you name it. It's really more about what do you have a passion for and how does that align with the free time that you have and the potential market that you have to do that. Yelp certainly is full of people that have tons of side hustles, whether it's fixing things for people that are broken. So they're all out there. I think it's just a matter of picking something, staying at it, but also making sure that it doesn't interfere or unstabilize the rest of your life.
Rick Cobb, founder of the workplace consulting firm 2Discern in Chicago, thank you for joining us today. Join us at this time tomorrow for Technology Thursday, and still to come, pondering the future of the Macy's store in the Loop.
The only program dedicated to currency events. You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
As Macy's closes a host of locations, including a flagship store in downtown Philadelphia, the future of the State Street store in Chicago is a topic of discussion. Joining us to discuss is Rachel Herzog, reporter for Crane Chicago Business. Rachel, thank you for joining us today. And the State Street store, the former Marshall Field's flagship, really is the last of its kind, Rachel, not only just in the world of American retail, but also on State Street. It's the last of the great department store buildings. And I guess the question is its time borrowed time?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Rob. And I think, Macy's closed these 66 stores in other markets. They still have about, 90 more stores that they'll close. I don't think Chicago area stores are out of the woods quite yet. But with the downtown flagship, just asking experts about it, they say it's unlikely that it would close. It would be really difficult for the chain to close just because it is the Midwest flagship. It has that regional importance and likely lifts the sales of other stores in the region due to that branding.
Now, the downtown flagship store that it closed in Philadelphia is the former Wanamaker's location. It has a very similar history that Marshall Field's had in Chicago and the Midwest, and the buildings look awfully similar, the Center City location. If you look at a picture of the Wanamaker's in Philadelphia, it looks an awful lot like the State Street store in Chicago. And I believe that's by design. One inspired the other. So it can happen. But how big of a deal, outside of the fact that it's the Macy's Midwest flagship, how much of a difference maker is Christmas and Santa Land and the Walnut Room and the windows in terms of keeping that store viable?
Yeah, I mean, I think those events and just kind of all of that, all of those things that drive foot traffic there and make people want to go specifically to that downtown Macy's are a big impact. I can't speak to, specifically that store's sales, but I do think those things have an impact, especially as, foot traffic is still recovering and, is coming back to pre-pandemic levels. But I think those kind of events are really helpful in just driving people to that store.
And also, of the 66 locations they are closing, it seems like it's a lot of shopping mall or shopping center-based locations, and maybe that type of, let's go to the mall and go to the store and pick up a few things, that has migrated online. But the trip downtown to go see Santa at Macy's or formerly Marshall Field's, that's still an event. And people like to take part in events, and events are more important today than they were before.
Yeah, definitely. And I think in addition to Christmas shopping, you do have a downtown flagship does lift those online sales. You don't always think about, an established brand like Macy's having an online business. But the downtown store is, it's convenient to so many people. People can go in and try stuff on. They have everything and then order online. So brick and mortar does kind of support that online business as well.
Rachel Herzog, reporter, Crane Chicago Business. Thank you for joining us today. You'll find past programs and later today a podcast of this hour at WBBM News. Radio.com and the Odyssey app.